contact.com.
Welcome to True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed and Samar. On today's program, we'll be speaking about the elections in the Middle East, starting with the Tunisian elections that happened over last Sunday, the results of that, as well as the latest developments with the elections in Israel and what's happening in Egypt. There is a planned protest that's supposed to take place in a couple of hours from now. Is it going to actually happen or not? All that and more when we come back. This is True Talk on WMNF. Summer, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Ahmed. This is a lovely song by Tunisian Amal Al-Maslouti, and she was singing it at the Nobel Peace Prize event in 2015. And she's from Tunisia, and she's saying, Ahmed, kalimati hurra, my word is free. And of course, she is trying to reflect the millions of Arabs who went to the streets in what is now called the Arab Spring, trying to get rid of authoritarian systems that are totally and absolutely supported by Western open society.
Yeah, overnight, Samar, we actually, because we were planning on talking about the results of the Tunisia election, and this is a Tunisian singer singing this song, My Word is Freedom, or My Word is Free. Is that a proper translation?
Yeah, kalimati hurra, my word is free, meaning like I have the right to speak my mind. And she is reflecting the civil disobedience that all the Arab people and masses tried to pursue in order to get rid of people like Zain al-Abidin bin Ali, who passed away yesterday, by the way, Ahmed, the president of Tunisia, who was a dictator, and people all over the Arab world who tried to get rid of their authoritarian dictators. But, you know, there are so many of them that the West loves and keeps and maintains. So it's interesting and ironic.
When you say, okay, for people that are not familiar with our program, when you say the West loves, I think most of the West doesn't know bin Ali. So what do you mean when you say the West loves these people, these dictators?
Well, let's talk about Hosni Mubarak when he was in power.
Hosni Mubarak was the president of Egypt.
Yeah. I mean, he was torturing people. We were doing rendition, sending people who the U.S. would like to torture, but our laws do not allow for torture. So we send them to Egypt, for instance, to be tortured. People can be imprisoned for writing an article or posting something on Facebook. And at the same time, he was getting billions of dollars in military aid from the U.S. Although we have...
Now, the military aid that he's getting from the U.S., Hosni Mubarak, Egypt, by the way, is the second highest recipient of military aid from the United States after Israel. But this deal was struck as a result of Camp David, when the peace agreement was signed between Israel and Egypt. One of the requirements or parts of the deal was that the United States will continue to send something like, you know, $1.3 billion, $1.2 billion of military aid every year. But that's more to protect Israel's interests, right?
Yeah, fine. That's no problem. But when people come, like, you know, you and I are public speakers, and I used to teach at USF, and the first thing people, when I go and they ask me why the Arabs and Muslims accept democratization, why can't they, like, have elections? As if, you know, there is some gene in ours, or there is some food that we eat that makes us anti-democratization. So that's what I'm saying, you know, people point fingers at the masses for not rising up or demanding democratic change. Yet when they do it, like in the Arab Spring, no one supports them. But most importantly, it's very important to understand that the money and these systems stay in power because of our financial aid, because we do not expose their crimes, because we do not raise issues whenever they imprison dissidents and writers and authors, and when they kill people and when they torture them in prison, when New York Times and Washington Post and The Guardian and all these Western free press do not raise these issues and ask questions, these people in power stay longer in power and are protected by the Western silence.
So that's in summary. Right.
That's how we deal with Iran when it imprisons an author or a poet, and how we deal with Egypt or any other.
I want to clarify to our listeners, when we say we, you're speaking about the U.S. government, because You know, some people may confuse what you mean by we. The U.S. government, which, you know, and a lot of times, especially when it comes to foreign policy, our radio show here, our program, which has been on for 16 years, has opposed a lot of the different foreign policy initiatives, especially when it comes to the Middle East, of this double standard. And that's, I think that's what you're referring to. Here at home, we promote our government here in the United States, for the most part, does promote, or at least in word, promote democracy and the right to for self-determination and participatory government and being involved and getting people out to vote. But how we deal with people or policies overseas and the policies we're pushing overseas oftentimes contradict our values here at home. And I think that's what you're saying. So when it comes to like dictators that are in the Middle East that ruled there for so long, the United States continued to have, you know, relationships with those governments and in many ways supported them and funded them. And when the Arab Spring happened, it was an opportunity for the U.S. government to get on the right side of history. And most of the time, they were either blindsided by what was happening there. And in other parts, they actually opposed it in places like Egypt. But eventually, when it was pretty obvious that Hosni Mubarak would fall, they started supporting the transition to democracy. But it was short-lived. So out of all the Arab Spring countries, the only nation that actually succeeded was Tunisia, barely making it. And they just had their second or third round, or this is their second time around, to have free elections for the presidency. And we have with us Munji Dawadouli from Washington, D.C. He's a Tunisian citizen, and I think he was also in Tunis during the elections. Welcome to the program, Munji.
Thank you, Ahmed. Good morning. And Munji Dawadi.
Dawadi, yes. I always mess up your name for some reason because it seems so non-Arab. I don't know.
An Arabic name spelled in French and pronounced in English, so bound to be mispronounced.
Okay, so Munji, you were in Tunis when this election happened. It was last Sunday. First, tell us what was the turnout?
Thank you for having me. Again, yeah, I was there for about a month and a half, and I just came back on Monday, the day after the elections that took place this past Sunday, September 15th. The turnout was actually kind of disappointing. It was around close to 40%. The reason for that is because there was a huge spike of new people who registered to vote. That made the total people registered and eligible to vote in Tunisia about 7 million. But we did not see, and all indications, all the polls were showing that there's a lot of interest. That we will have an election that has 70% turnout, but we didn't have that. We had about 40% only. So the turnout was a little...
How does that compare to the previous election?
The turnout has been sliding back since the beginning, since the first election that took place in 2011. That was the first parliamentary election. And then after that, the 2014... I think the first election was about the 70 or a little bit more than 70%. And then it kept sliding back up until last year when we had local elections in 2018, where we saw about 50%, less than that. Again, about 35, 40%. And we, you know, we thought that this is more important. This was an early presidential election. As you know, Ahmed, Tunisia has elections every 5 years. We have the parliamentary first, and then a month or a month and a half later, we do the presidential election. But since the our late president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, passed away, and so we had to, the body that's in charge of running the elections had to switch the order of elections. So usually the parliamentary election is first, and then that was supposed to be, you know, it is October 6th, and the presidential election was supposed to be in November, but they had to make it earlier in September. And that kind of threw a lot of political calculations out the window.
Yeah, this was not a planned election at this time. When did the former president pass away?
He passed away early in July. So the Z had to, last time I was on your show, we spoke about that. It was about a week when he passed away.
Right, so it was just, it was in July. Now, normally in the United States, if the president, you know, dies or passes away while in office, the vice president becomes a president, and they don't have a whole new election. But in Tunis and in many other parts of the world that works on a party-based election system or parliamentary election system, they do it differently. So he died in July. When did they announce the election day?
They immediately. It was the same day he died.
And they already set it for September for like 2 months later.
Yeah. They pulled. They you know made the presidential elections early. They set it up for September 15th. But the campaign there, what's different also about Tunisia is that campaigning for the election is not an open season. Like you cannot just campaign anytime you want. The campaign is only about 2 weeks long.
Say that again. So like this is the presidential campaign.
Even the parliamentary.
Or parliamentary. But we're just talking about presidential campaign for now. And the term is 5 years. And you're saying that the time for campaigning, the campaign, I guess, term, is defined by law?
It is defined by law. And you can announce your candidacy. You can say, I'm running for president anytime you want. But you are not allowed to start the typical campaigning, you know, meetings and rallies and
advertisement. What about advertisements?
Advertisement, all of that. You are not. You can't do that. That's set by law.
So, and you're saying this is only 2 weeks?
2 weeks, and it ended on the Friday, this past Friday, the September 13th, and you have Saturday, which they call the silence. It's a 24-hour period where that's it. Everything stops. Nothing is allowed.
Is that intended so the voters can just figure things out, you know, and eliminate noise?
Yeah, it's actually nice because I was there and it was, I was involved in the whole process and observing what's happening. And it's kind of nice, actually, to have that one day where everybody kind of, you know, settles down, all the ads are off, nobody's talking on TV from the candidates. And you actually focus, a lot of the parties, especially the ones who have observers, they actually use that day to kind of organize themselves and do like internal meetings and set up things where, you know, where they're going to send the people to observe the elections or who's going to be where. And all that, and then Sunday is the day.
Okay, let's just get to some of the other things. But before that, I just want to say to our listeners, if you're just joining us, this is Ahmed Bedir with my co-host Samar Jarrah, and we're speaking to Monjid Dawadi. He is a Tunisian American, and he was recently observing and participating in the Tunisia election that took place last Sunday. There were dozens of candidates running, but one of the most surprising things that I'm learning right now or have learned through this, you know, following this election is that the election campaign term or season for the presidential election there is 2 weeks. So imagine here where it goes on for 2 years or longer, there it's just for 2 weeks. How many candidates were on the slate?
About 26.
26 candidates. That's like as much as the Democratic primary that's happening now. So 2 weeks to learn about 26 candidates. The election happened on Sunday. There was some shock as far as the results are concerned because the winners that came out of it were people who were basically considered outsiders. Who are the winners?
The winners, we have Qais Saied. He's a professor of the constitutional professor. He's an independent. He is the one who had about 18.4% of the votes. And the number two came is Nabil Al-Qarawi. He has a new political party that he established only a few months before the election, and he had 15.6%. And the reason these two are important, these two spots, is because in Tunisia, if you don't get more than 50% in the first round, then we take the first two and we do the second round. So
the top two vote getters will
not over yet. So this is the first phase is over. We have two winners, the number one, number two spot, and these two will the body that's set for that takes care of the election did not announce the date of the second round, but it has to be within a month or a month and a half, I would suspect.
So there'll be a runoff election and the winner of that. Now, one of the interesting thing is the person named Nabil, he is actually in jail, and he during the whole time he was of the presidential election, he was in jail. So he was campaigning from behind the cell?
Yeah, well, I mean, his wife was basically doing the campaigning for him and the whole his whole team. And he was able to beat some major political parties. He was able to beat three former head of government, including the present one. He was able to beat, several other ministers, previous ministers, including the defense minister. He was able to beat the heavy machine of Nahda and Abdel Fattah Mourou, who presides over the parliament right now. And so these two candidates who won really were a surprise. I mean, the polls were indicating that they were going to win, but nobody believed that. Everybody expected that the polls to be kind of have some outcome.
And they didn't have, especially this Professor Qais, he didn't have any traditional, he didn't even have a political party behind him. And did not have the money. However, this Nabil, he has money. He's seen as some like multimillionaire. He owns a television network, and he's a bit controversial because people were saying that he was using his television to promote his charitable giving and using his stature to distribute charity and especially food to the poor, and that's who ended up supporting him a lot.
There is a lot of drama in this election. So in the case of Nabil Al-Qarawi, who owns a big TV channel called Nisma, and about 2 years ago, his son died in an accident. So what he did, he created a charity under his name, Khalil, and he used that charity, he used his TV station to do a lot of good, what people were applauding him for doing. And so he would collect money from the people, he would do these marathons and collects money and then distributes all across Tunisia, and he would film it and show it on his TV station. But then he came a few months before the election and turned all that machine and that image that he built for himself and announced that he's running for president. At that time, he already had some runnings with the law and issues and some problems for money laundering and tax evasion and all kinds of stuff. And so, but he was, and he started running. The parliament passed a law to prevent him from doing that because he used a loophole in the law. So the parliament passed the law, and the problem is Bajikai Tsipsi, the late president, did not sign the law before he died. And not signing the law renders the law, basically as if it wasn't passed. And so he was able to keep running and turn that whole machine, that whole image that he built for himself into politics. And that's how he built these numbers. Now, Qais Saied, on the other hand, is a known figure since 2011 after the election. He's known to be, invited speaker on several platforms where he was asked about the Constitution, asked about different questions regarding the elections or issues that raises from now and then. But he built this image about himself as being a straightforward, very clear. He speaks the Fusha, the classical Arabic. He doesn't, when he answers. And also he's totally independent, clean person, he's not involved in any politics. But that image kept building up, and everybody is surprised. And how did he turn that and those people around him into this huge victory is still a mystery to this day.
Okay, Summer.
He doesn't have any offices. He doesn't have any budget. He doesn't have any party or any big network. But he did win.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Yamunji. Summer, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to remind our listeners, Ahmed, they're listening to True Talk, and very soon we're going to be fundraising to keep WMNF floating on the air and to keep True Talk on the air. Ahmed and I don't get paid to do this amazing show that has been going on for the past 15 years, where we can give you voices like Munji's voice from Tunisia He lives in the U.S. in Washington, D.C., but he is giving us an amazing summary of what is going on in one of the most important events that happened in the 21st the Arab world. Munji, I wanted to know if there were any women running, and also what happened to Munsif al-Marzouqi. You know, he in a way represents the, I'm not sure if I should say that, but maybe a little bit of an Islamist leaning, and he was the first president of Tunisia. I think he was elected by the assembly. And he was defeated. I would like you to talk about that and him, and are people leaning more towards, or are they leaving Islamism? You know, in the West, they are afraid of Muslim Brotherhood or Islamic-leaning candidates and presidents. Is that happening in Tunisia? And the role of women in all this?
Right. Well, looking at the elections, at least looking at where the women voted, comparing the number one and number two for these, the two people that won and went to the second round, women and men pretty much voted the same. Like the, you look at the percentages, and they pretty much, you know, men and women voted their own way. So they split the votes, 18% here, 20% there. So there's not a heavyweight like it was in 2014. A lot of the women votes went to Bejified City. As far as Munsif al-Marzouqi, he was running. Don't forget, in 2014, the major supporter of Munsif al-Marzouqi, all those votes came from a Nahda party, because at that time, Nahda did not run a candidate of its own. And so all, pretty much all of, or most of its voters went to Munsif al-Marzouqi. This time, because Nahda, you know, had its own candidate, its vice president, Abdel Fattah Mourou. And so naturally, the party and the party members and its supporters, most of their votes went for him. And that explains the very low percentage that Munsif al-Marzouqi received in these elections. He received about 3%. So we did have a one woman candidate. She was the former tourism minister. Salma Lumi, she did not perform well in some of the debates, and she was not charismatic enough, I think. She was also considered as part of the establishment, and all of these votes, very much anybody who had to do anything with the government and the old regime and the old system, pretty much suffered a blow. And so she, one day before the election, about 2 days before the election, she threw her support behind somebody else, and she withdrew from the running. But her name stayed on the ballot, and I think she received about 0.5% or so. So those are the numbers. Actually, we'll be able to tell more about the story of the elections in Tunisia as the numbers become available.
Can you tell us about the president? He passed away, Zain al-Abidin, in Saudi Arabia. Will he be buried in Tunisia? What's the mood there in Tunisia after his passing? He was never put on riot or any of his family.
I mean, as you can imagine, I mean, the country Tunisia has been going through this roller coaster for about 2 months now, since the passing of Bejified Sibsi. We're getting into these elections. And then the interesting part is, on the day of the election, Bejified Sibsi's wife also passed away, and her funeral was this past Monday. At the same time, also, we just heard yesterday that Zain al-Abidin, the former dictator of Tunisia, passed away in Saudi Arabia. And so people were kind of withdrawing some parallels. They say the system in Tunisia has died on the day of the election, and Zain al-Abidin followed by dying in Saudi Arabia. And so there's a lot of mixed emotions. There's a lot of polarization. People who suffered under his regime physically, emotionally, and mentally continue. Some of them even continue to suffer till today. They have some strong reactions to his passing. You know, some people expressed that they already forgave him and forgot. and they moved on with their life. Others are still holding on, and they. So there was a huge debate erupted yesterday. As far as him being buried in Tunisia, I don't think the family even asked. I think he, as far as I know, from his lawyer, he said that he wanted to be buried in Saudi Arabia. He did not want to be buried in Tunisia. So that debate kind of fizzled away because there was no request from the family to bring him to Tunisia.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed and Samar, and we're speaking to Munji Dawadi from Washington, D.C. He just returned from Tunisia. We're speaking about the Tunisian elections that took place this last Sunday. And two outsiders without much political experience rose to the top, and now they'll face each other in a runoff election. Munji, before you leave us, so many years after the Arab Spring, 8 years later, where Arab populations, rose up against their governments, calling for democracy and freedom, it failed everywhere else except Tunisia. What's the difference? How did it succeed there, in your opinion? Or it failed in other places?
There's a lot of reasons, and we spoke about this. One big part of it is I think the Tunisian population, we're very homogeneous. We don't have these cracks. We don't have these big divisions in society. Also, our military was a very civil military. I was there during this past election, and I was going from one post to the next, and the military was right outside these poll stations, and they were guarding, the elections, but they were never even allowed to walk into the building where the election is taking place because that's a sign of them being involved, and they were respecting that. So you would see this insistence on them guarding the election, guarding the process, guarding democracy, basically, but they are never, there was never an attempt even from them to get involved and messing it up. And so that forced the Tunisians to resolve any of its political issues and turmoils and problems through dialogue, through the ballot box, through building coalitions and, splitting here, building a networks there. And so, and we see how from 2011, we saw the rise of Ennahda and some of its friends. Then in 2014, the rise of the old regime back in power with Beji Caid Sibsi and his Nida Tunis. And now we see the complete dismantle of that old system and the rise of two people from outside. Qadhawi is not completely outside the system, but he's brought some outside take into the election. But Qais Saied is completely from outside, and he is bringing back the old revolution kind of mentality that he wants to come in and revolutionize things, but pay a lot of attention to the social aspect, what we now try to call a social democracy. That democracy, we have succeeded in the political arena, but this success now has to trickle down to economics and the social life, and people need to feel some prosperity and some of that result of the of democracy. So hopefully we'll succeed in this next round.
Thank you, Munji, for joining us on True Talk, and good luck, and we hope to speak to you again next time after the runoff elections.
It, and I do support the work that you do on this network, and it's an important work, and I hope that people who are listening will support you by donating to this campaign. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and when we come back, we'll speak about other elections that happened in the Middle East and in Israel, and I'll leave you with this song for now. We are Tunisia.
في البلاد الكل نار تشعل في الطابونة ريحة بو عرقو بتفل وشمسة برقة هي الكل والمرسى راهي شامخة سوسة راهي شامخة سلم على أم الزين وغني والكل
Welcome back to True Talk on WMNF 88.5. That was a song, We Are Tunisia. We were speaking about the results of the Tunisia election that happened last Sunday. Now we want to shift to the elections that happened in Israel also this week. Samar, are you still there?
Yeah, Ahmed, I just want to interrupt if you don't mind. But I want to remind our listeners, I'm going to be speaking in Sarasota this coming Tuesday, September 24th.
But what about?
Religion in Sarasota series. It's at the USF campus, and I think it's called Sainer Auditorium. I can look up the address, but at 5 o'clock, I'm going to be having a conversation about religion on my books in Arabic and in English.
Do you ever get tired of talking about religion and Islam?
People don't get tired. Arts and Humanities of Florida, the new college in Sarasota at 5 o'clock next Tuesday.
So new college, not USF. People, new college.
No, it's the new college. I'm so sorry. The new college in Sarasota. And it's going to be... They finally had a professor that teaches Islamic studies. You know, people are always interested and curious and want to know, Ahmed. So I don't get tired. I get tired sometimes when people ask, you know, the same questions about the hijab. While they have Google, they can Google it and they can get the answer very quickly. But, I mean, people are curious and they want to know and they still want to know more. So, no, I don't get tired, actually. I enjoy it, but sometimes, as I told you, I get tired from the same questions. Like, there aren't new questions sometimes. But the professor is very smart. She knows a bit of Arabic, so she ordered my two books that I wrote in Arabic. And she also ordered my book in English. So she's going to be, like, kind of talking about things about our lives as American Muslims after September 11, how it changed, how, you know, things are. So I expect this conversation to be a little bit different. It's not like she's going to ask me why do you wear the hijab, why women are abused, blah, 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 blah. No, it's going to be more current and more, I think, relatable to people and students especially. So this is next Tuesday at 5 o'clock at the new college in Tampa. I just wanted to say that.
Okay, speaking of election, of current events, thank you, Samar, for letting, I'm sure we have, you know, main listeners in Sarasota that would be interested in going. But you're speaking of current events, there was an election in Israel that happened this week, and the results, it was too close to call for some time, and finally today, Benjamin Netanyahu's rival, Benny Gantz, declares victory in the Israeli election. Now, it's, I think he had one or two more seats, his coalition or his party, more than Netanyahu's. But again, it still leaves Israel in a political gridlock. This is a redo election. This is a second one that took place in the last 5 or 6 months. A similar election took place with similar results back in April, I believe. And in that situation, the president of Israel tapped Benjamin Netanyahu to have, you know, the chance to build a coalition government or build a government. The way it works there is if your party does not reach political majority, does not get more than 50% of the seats, then it has to build a coalition with other smaller political parties until you reach that 50%. And then you're able to form some sort of government. But the last time around in negotiations, Netanyahu could not form the government together, so then they had to do a redo election. And now again, neither side seems to have enough votes or enough seats to have a majority despite their coalitions. And but, you know, they still have to wait for the president to decide if they're going to tap who he will ask to actually have the first chance to form a government. And just because, and you know, I think this is right, just because one person or one party got the majority of the seats does not mean that the president is obligated to pick that party to actually form the government when it's so close. So some are saying that Benjamin Netanyahu, despite losing, may still get a chance or may have a role in the future government. Benny Gantz and his party saying they don't mind joining force or having a coalition government with Benjamin Netanyahu's party, Likud, as long as Benjamin Netanyahu is not part of it. Benjamin Netanyahu, after Election Day, also went on television, or actually in his acceptance, not acceptance speech, but in the speech at his the night of the election, said there's no way that he would allow a coalition government that includes Arab politicians. And we say Arab politicians, there is a segment or a there are Arab Israelis, or those they are Arabs who have Israeli citizenship, and they vote in the election. And this time around, they apparently voted in large numbers. And now you have they increase their seats in the parliament by 30%. Summer.
Ahmed, I don't like to call them Arab, because, like, when you say Arab, you are an Arab. So are there Egyptians in the...
okay, Palestinian. Well, what would you call them then?
They are Palestinian.
Palestinian Israelis?
Yes, who remained and did not flee or were not kicked out when the State of Israel was formed in 1948. So they are the indigenous people. It's like Native Americans if they run for office and you say English speakers. So they can be British. They can be...
Correct. You make a good point. That's right. So this is just to describe when Israel came in, especially, after the United Nations partition, or where they divided the land, later on in subsequent wars or attacks, the Israeli military went in and occupied those territories. And during the violence, many of these Palestinians, indigenous people to the land, fled out of fear because of the war, thinking they'll be able to return back home. Yes?
All the ethnic cleansing started before the Arab armies entered to try to save and rescue the people. If people should go to Ilan Pape books, Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, the ethnic cleansing of my father's town, and there is a whole massacre named after my maiden name, Dahmash, D-A-H-M-A-S-H, the Dahmash Mosque Massacre. All this happened pre-1948 when the armies came in. The ethnic cleansing started before any war took place, and it was going on for a while. And then some Arab armies entered.
So there was some. There were people who became refugees or left their land before 48 and also after.
Yes.
Correct.
Well, anyways.
But, I mean, the point I was trying to make was there are some communities... and some Palestinians that did not leave their land and could not, were able to stay and remain. And today, because they stayed there, they have Israeli citizenship. Would that be accurate?
They have Israeli citizenship. Many of them, of course, speak Hebrew. They go to, many of them actually still go to Arabic schools, but when it comes to higher education, they go to Israeli universities. There are about 78 laws that discriminate against them when it comes to property ownership or owning business or some type of job that they cannot get. So although they are the indigenous people, but there are about 78 laws that discriminate against them, or 87, I'm not sure.
They're not only indigenous people, but they also have Israeli citizenship. So you're saying they have Israeli citizenship, they're also indigenous, but their citizenship is not the same as a Jewish person?
No, there is discrimination. Plus, for instance, one of the things Netanyahu wanted to do is that to profess the Jewishness of the state, and your loyalty is to the Jewishness of the state. Okay, but I am atheist. What does this have to do with me being a citizen of a nation state that has to be, you are only Jewish. You can be part of this state if you are Jewish. What if you are Christian? What if you are Muslim? What if you are Baha'i? What if you are from the Druze? So that's where, for instance, instance, why people like Jimmy Carter, the former president of the U.S., called it an apartheid state, because you do not treat all your citizens equally. We're not talking about the occupied people in the West Bank and Gaza and Jerusalem. We're talking about the citizens, these citizens who have Israeli passports, who travel through the same airport and go to the same nations that other Jewish Israelis go through. These people are discriminated against. But Ahmed, really, there is something I just saw now. I'm looking at the Los Angeles Times. Jason Greenblatt, who I think also resigned, but he is one of the architects of what is called the Deal of the Century, is now in Israel, or he is arriving now to Israel to hold discussions with Netanyahu and Gantz, because he doesn't know if the president of Israel is going to pick Netanyahu to form a government, like you were just saying, or he's going to pick Gantz. So here is an American diplomat going to a foreign country trying to influence behind the scenes, it's not very much behind the scenes, the outcome of the elections, or to guarantee that if it's Netanyahu, he's on the same page of Kushner. If it's Gantz, he is on the same page of Kushner. So this is something I just read now on the...
That's your assessment that's why he's going there.
Oh, that's what I'm reading. Let me quote it. President Trump, a Mideast envoy, announced that he would be arriving in Israel to hold separate discussions with Netanyahu and Gantz on Trump's long-anticipated peace deal for Israelis and Palestinians.
Mm.
I'm not making this up.
As far as the election results are concerned, it seems like it basically still has, it shows that the country, one, is polarized, and Netanyahu continued to go further to the right, aligning himself with some very right-wing, some would say extremist, religious, ethnic groups within Israel, those that some of them that were disciples or students or followers of the former rabbi or extremist rabbi Kahane, who their group was classified as a terrorist organization within Israel, as well as in the United States. But Netanyahu, because he was desperate to form a coalition or to have partners, actually partnered up with this extreme right-wing party, but that party failed to get even a single seat in the election. So that risk or that gamble to be able to partner up with him did not, bring him any new fortune. However, one of the parties that did turn out in higher numbers and actually increased their numbers is the Arab party. And I was reading that there was a lot of grassroots. I say it's the Arab party because that's how they describe it in the news, but you're saying to call them Palestinian Israelis. Their numbers increased because they were doing a lot of grassroots voter registration, turning out the vote. And they participated in large numbers. And there were some headlines that actually said that it's because of this that this group became a swing group, and they were able to deny Netanyahu the victory that he thought he would get because, of his extreme rhetoric. That was a motivation for many of these Palestinians to actually go out and vote against Netanyahu.
Yeah, but not very popular among the larger Palestinian indigenous people of Israel. So many of the Palestinians are against participating in such a system. It's a system that discriminates against you. How can you be part of it? You're not going to be able to...
But you can't deny, of course, I see that point, but you can't deny the fact that people did participate. So a number of them did actually go out and vote, and they increased the numbers within the Knesset. And this made a significant blow to Netanyahu. But as you said, many Palestinians, especially the ones that are not within the Israeli state or within the...
Even within the Israeli state, they boycott.
Right, no, but I was trying to make a different point. to say Palestinians inside and outside of Israel, meaning in the occupied territories, in what is supposed to be or what was promised to be an independent Palestinian nation, sovereign nation that never actually took place. Within those, in both sides, are saying that they don't expect anything to really change much, regardless of who wins. The apartheid system will continue, the discrimination will continue, and their lives will not improve. Is that what you're hearing also?
Yeah, but Vic, I know we're running out of time, Ahmed, and I want to mention this book. I interviewed David Kirkpatrick, I think maybe the beginning of this year. I'm going to go have to go to the record. But remember, we were talking about the Arab Spring. So I spoke to David Kirkpatrick, Ahmed, and he has written a fascinating book. It's called Into the Hands of the Soldiers. He had just, I think, moved to Egypt. As soon as the Tunisian revolution was starting, and he went to Egypt and people told him, it's a boring post. And then he was in the midst of the revolution. The reason I mentioned the book, Ahmed, because he is talking hour by hour, minute by minute, day by day, how the Obama administration wanted to deal with what is going on in Tahrir Square. So he says that Obama was like looking at the television and saying, finally, these people are going to democratize. Finally, these people are using civil disobedience. And he wanted to abandon Hosni Mubarak on the spot and be on the side of the people. And the whole administration and the State Department and all what they call, you know, the deep state of the USA was against him and telling him, no, we don't do this. We don't do democratization in the Arab world. So, Ahmed, I really urge people to go to the book Into the Hands of the Soldiers by David Kirkpatrick, and maybe what we can do if one time you and I are busy and traveling, we can replay this interview to see how the play of how they convinced Obama stems the spite of the millions of the people who wanted to get rid of him. I just wanted to get
okay.
That.
But as far as my question, that things are not going to change much for the Palestinians regardless of who wins. I mean, Benny Gantz seems to be, more measured with his language as far as his rhetoric, but it seems like the policies are not much different than Netanyahu.
Yeah, he just bombed Gaza. He was responsible for the bombing of Gaza into the Dark Ages. That's fine. Maybe he is just more diplomatic than Netanyahu. But remember, Netanyahu is supposed to be going to prison, he and his wife, because of their corruption. I mean,
that's true. I mean, this was many people saw this election as a way for him. He needed to be able to control the government so he could pass a new law that gives him immunity, or at least he would have immunity while serving in office. But now he is in trouble if he is not able to do that, because the prosecution and the police have recommended indicting Benjamin Netanyahu. But it's just so strange.
And his wife, because she was stealing from the catering. Like when they do catering in their home, she would be hiking the bill. I mean, the woman is really disgusting. But some people told me they're going to be in the same prison of Ehud Olmert, and it's a fancy prison, so it's not really like kind of our prisons where people are going to be really serving harsh sentence. So, but yeah, he wanted to create a law to give him immunity.
Okay, that for now it doesn't seem like that's happening, but with Netanyahu, you never know. We're out of time. Summer, thank you for joining us. Enjoy the weekend for you and our listeners. We'll be right here, same time, same place at WMNF.org and 88.5. Next Friday, 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. This is True Talk on WMNF. NPR News is next, and after that, it's Radioactivity with Rob Laura. Have a great weekend. Take care.